Hi, everyone, and welcome to Televisions, the podcast, an audio companion to the Televisions website and a show made by Anglophiles for Anglophiles. I am Lacey Barger-Milas, and I'm the editor here at Televisions. And joining me, as usual, is my co-host, Miss Annie Bundle.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you today?
Oh, fine, guess.
You're fine, you guess?
Well, today has not necessarily gone according to plan, so that is somewhat frustrating.
That is very true. Today has definitely, like, not behaved itself at all. I would like today to go sit in a corner and think about what it's done, like, several times. However, I mean, it could be worse. It could be Tuesday.
I don't know why that... I mean, I guess it's good because we're recording this on a Friday, but
I mean, I guess. Tuesday's just... I don't seem to be able to get the hang of Tuesdays. I don't know why. Tuesdays just don't behave themselves sometimes. Anyway, what are we talking about today, other than the fact that it's not actually Tuesday, even though this quarter drops on Tuesday, which is probably confusing our listeners very badly, and I probably shouldn't have said that, and oh well. I never say anything correct anyway.
Stop talking. Just stop talking. Today, we are going to talk about, finally, not any of the shows that I've hated recently, but something I actually mostly liked. I've got some nitpicks, but I think no one is going to be surprised to learn that I greatly enjoyed Starz as Mary and George. Very sort of lavish period drama with a kind of, let's just call it, raunchy edge to it a little bit. It's definitely like not your mom's costume drama, if you will, and you probably shouldn't let your moms watch it if they are of a certain age. I know that my mom would freak out. just saying. Anyway, we are welcoming Janet Mullaney onto the show this week because she reviewed it for us and also because she likes this stuff like I do. So let's go. Yeah. Hey, Janet.
Hello. Well, thanks for inviting me. And I enjoyed it too. And I'm probably the age of most of your mothers. So there's always the exception to the rule.
My mom still calls Madonna trash and filth. So trash and filth is like her phrase for stuff that she hates. And I can say that on this show because my mom doesn't know what a podcast is. So she will literally never hear this. But I feel like she would almost certainly call the show trash and filth.
My mother-in-law, who also does not know what a podcast is, so I can get away with saying this, thinks Carol Burnett is trashy. So, yeah.
What strange families you have.
Yes, I know. Like
almost as strange as the Villiers, but in a different way, fortunately.
Yes, at least my mother understood immediately what Mary and George was the moment I began to explain it. But then again, she also knows what podcasts are and is actually quite aware that we are recording this as I am in her office. She also saw Janet's review. So, yeah, I mean, honestly, this is what.
Yeah, does your mom like Mary and George?
You know, these kinds of.
Or did your mom watch Mary and George?
My mom has not actually watched Mary and George yet, but she understands that this kind of period drama where it's basically balls out, like everything goes like shock value, let's get naked and just have men hanging out with all their hanging out, is really just sort of what period dramas do right now. And that's, you know, it's just the new style of period drama.
I mean, I think it's worth saying that most period dramas don't do this right now.
No, but that this is...
There's a trend towards sort of like edgier period drama, but like this is quite an order of magnitude past that, which... Yeah. Is not the show's fault, as it has chosen a particularly salacious bit of history to adapt.
Yeah,
and
I think when she said that, she was thinking more like of the Serpent Queen. You know, the Serpent Queen wasn't quite this raunchy, but it definitely had that sort of like, you know, let's watch the two in bed scene. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was very much in your face about the way people behaved at the time, and so I think
disagree
that's
with that somewhat.
Yeah, strong use of the vernacular.
Yeah,
to put it mildly. Yes.
Yes. Yes. I will say the language is definitely adult, but I don't know. I think this is not quite in the same lane as the Serpent Queen. Although I do think it makes like a nice fit on Starz, which
yes.
It was supposed to be AMC originally.
I found the language sort of annoying. I thought it was very limited. And I thought also that people would be swearing in different ways and they would be swearing, bringing in Christian symbolism like the cross and Christ's death and that sort of thing. And it would have been really badass stuff. Am I allowed to say that? Oh, I did.
We'll see. This episode is probably going to get an adult content warning anyway. Yes. But yeah, this is. Let me just say that straight up before we get into any more of this. We're only going to be talking about the first two episodes of this show in detail, but I think we're going to talk about some broad strokes of the show as a whole. And this show deals with very mature subject matter, including a lot of sex, a lot of language, a sort of willing prostitution sort of situation, power dynamics, like sexual power dynamics. Like if this is just going to be a lot for you, like just keep it moving and don't listen to this, just so you guys know.
Yes, and there are some very nasty things that happen in it because it was a very nasty period in history. There was a lot of violence. It was quite easy to get hanged. Life was very, very rough for people at the lower level of society. And you see this happening in it later on. There are people who are used and cast aside and betrayed, essentially, like Sir Walter Raleigh. Well, I mean, he wasn't bottom of the heap by any means. He'd been a favorite of Elizabeth's court, but he was just in trouble because James didn't like him.
I think we should probably take a second and back up and talk a little bit about what the show is about.
Yeah.
Because as period dramas go, this is not one of the things I really like about this show is that it's actually doing something that isn't Tudor era or Regency era England. Mm-hmm. It is set in the court of King James I, who was Elizabeth I's heir and the first ruler of a united Scotland and England. And
he was son of Mary, Queen of Scots.
Yeah. Which is a whole there's just a whole long rigmarole of his past and childhood that could be a show on its own. But he is king of England and Scotland now and has a lot of issues.
Yeah, this is I believe this is 1612, which is really not an era that we cover a lot. Mm-hmm. Like we see a lot of like the 1500s, the build up to Henry VIII. Let's back up. We see the War of the Roses, which is which is the late 1400s. We see the build up to Henry VIII in the Tudors in the early 1500s. We see Henry VIII in the late 1500s, in the mid 1500s. Then we see Elizabeth in the late 1500s, right? Mm-hmm. And then we get and then things sort of end with Shakespeare
/ early 1600s. Mm-hmm. Reigned for a long time,
right? And then and then we have Shakespeare, and then the history just kind of ends, and we jump to just before the Victorian era is kind of usually how it works, right? We sort of skip over things.
Well, you see, there were some embarrassing things that happened in the middle there, like, the interregnum and the civil, the other way around, the civil war and then the interregnum. And there have been a few dramas made of that, but not very many, because I think it's still something that embarrasses people. And talking of embarrassing people still, I think historians for a long time have chosen to ignore certain things about James I, who did actually get a lot of very bad press because he was Scottish and he was accused of slobbering when he talked. And I think it was just the Scottish accent. Sorry to any Scots people out there, but people weren't used to it. And that's something actually I would love to see in historicals.
Well, I mean, King James has a lot of people only know King James for the obvious reason of the existence of the King James Bible.
Right. And the gunpowder plot.
Okay, can I just say that I, as someone who is not Christian, did not actually know until I watched this show that this King James, who I have understood to have been LGBTQ, and that King James of the Bible were the same dude.
Well, okay. Yes. Let me back you up a little bit. I think as a historian I like very much often explains it, I think it's incorrect to ascribe our own ideas of sexual and gender identity to people who had no concept that those things existed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair.
King James definitely had a predilection for men. that is was an open secret at the time. Mm-hmm. He was also extremely devout because he started one of the biggest witch panics in Europe. He had the guy who wrote the Malleus Maleficarum, I think so.
Yes.
Which technically translates to Hammer of the Witches. Mm-hmm. So he imprisoned and killed a lot of people for being, you know, witches and Satanists and stuff. And he was really religiously devout. He also slept with men. It's a dichotomy that he would not have had the sort of same level of ability to discuss it mm-hmm. as we might now. So I think it's incorrect to call him LGBTQ, but he, you know, slept with men.
Yeah, it is because people did not define themselves by their sexuality. It was just something they did. And this is something that comes up in its several characters. Mary and Mary's lover at one point says, it's just bodies.
And that leads me back into the better summation of this, which is this show follows the story of the Villiers family, specifically Mary Villiers, who would go on to become the Countess of Buckingham, and her son, George Villiers, who would go on to become the Duke of Buckingham. And they became two of the most powerful people in all of England, two of the most powerful people at James's court. They literally were raised from relatively modest, you know, lifestyle standards to a reconstituted dukedom that James pretty much like reinstated for their family. They got tons of special privileges and money and positions and power. And they got all of this because James was infatuated with George. They mm-hmm. they were lovers and partners and were together for a significantly large chunk of his reign. George outlived him by about 5 years. Mm-hmm. And they were together for all of that time. And, you know, I don't think necessarily in terms of the way we understand together, I'm making air quotes, but they were in each other's lives. He was a favorite until James's death. And granted, there's not like a letter somewhere that proves this, but the generally accepted historical framing of it is that Mary basically groomed her son, who was also allegedly like preternaturally good looking, to pretty much honey trap the king and get the power and influence that she and her family did not possess by sleeping with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, also, the Villiers family were actually, they were very, very active during the 17th century, but right up through the 19th century, there were still descendants pulling strings behind the scenes. So they had a massive influence on history.
All because the son, the second son, let's put the pin in that, the second son was really hot.
I actually did not know a lot about the Villiers family before I watched this show. I did not know for a certain instance. I assumed that George was the first son. I did not know he was the second son until I watched this. I also did not know that Mary Villiers was actually base-born and that she'd basically been...
I don't think that's true.
I mean, I don't know that that's entirely true. She had some like aristocratic, you know, blood, if you will. But I think the family was on something of a downswing.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Also, the fact that she had been in service, this was something that happened, I mean, way up until probably mid-18th century or beyond, that... particularly younger children of families would be sent out, quote, in service, and they would do sort of undemanding jobs around the house. And it was to further their education. They'd get to know how a great household ran, and they would meet the right sort of people. So it wasn't an issue of shame. Yeah.
Like she did, basically. Okay. So I do have a question, though, about George. One of the things about this show, and I was very grateful for Janet to put a warning on our review. There's George attempts to is self-harming in the first couple of episodes mm-hmm. on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that, do we have any idea if that is true?
We have no idea. That's made up.
No, okay. I don't think so. Yeah.
Okay. I just don't know how much we actually know about like he sort of comes off of this sort of if one were to have a Byron as a son,
we know a surprising amount about him because mm-hmm. he simply was in power / popular for so long.
Mm-hmm.
But that is later in his life.
Okay. Because I sort of imagine that this must be what it would be like if one had a romantic poet for a son. Like, if one were to turn around and find themselves with a 19-year-old Byron, like, slumming around the house, like, you know, failing to launch. I sort of felt like this is what George kind of was.
No, I think it's just a trope the show uses to try to make it seem... well, not only to sort of draw that sort of bond between him and Mary closer because she's the one who keeps finding him doing all of these things,
mm-hmm.
but to, you know, look how sensitive and troubled he is, despite the fact that he's banging servant girls and throwing mm-hmm. himself in the path of the king, like just full force.
Yes.
George is not an innocent in this, mm-hmm. and I like the show better when it doesn't try to pretend that he is.
It's kind of hilarious how not innocent he is and how much he tries to pretend that he is. I mm-hmm. also, I have to say that I absolutely adore Julianne Moore in this role. Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking about how hard it used to be for women over the age of 40 to get roles in Hollywood, and how like Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman literally went and started their whole companies in order to like, you know, produce work so that they could work and have starring roles once they reached a certain age. And here is Julianne Moore, who is, I think, in her 50s or 60s.
She's 62.
She looks amazing.
She's in great
shape. She looks amazing. And she is out there just utterly like, this role was almost, I mean, this role is just stunning. She mm-hmm. is stunning in it. Mm. And the other thing about this that really surprised me, and, you know, we were a lot of editors that I know were joking about how this was basically about, you know, watch Julianne Moore pimp out her son. Who wants to cover the show where Julianne Moore pimps out her son? So I sort of got this idea that this show was basically going to be like the sexcapades of the Stuarts, you know, like I sort of, like that's what
right, it's not that.
No, it's not. But it's also like, it's funny, like it's politically funny. Like mm-hmm. it's got like it's not Game of Thronesy politics, but
no, it's got very dark. It's had very dark humor, mm-hmm. and it's something I feel like
it's beepish.
I kind of hate this because this is one of those rare instances where I've actually seen the whole thing because mm-hmm. I reviewed it.
Mm-hmm.
So I wish that I really love the first half of the show a little bit more than the second half because I feel like it has more of that sort of dark, transgressive
yes.
energy. Mm-hmm. That it kind of loses towards the back half.
Oh, that makes me sad because I have only watched the first two episodes. Yeah. I will be absolutely blunt.
My biggest complaint about it is that I wish it kept up that same level of just subversive glee
yeah.
that it has in the first couple of episodes. It eventually becomes something that will feel a lot more familiar to people yeah. that watch a lot of mm-hmm. period dramas, which mm-hmm. is a shame because I think the first half of it is truly excellent.
Yeah.
The second half is good.
Okay.
I think what happens is that George grows up, the king grows older. And so, and George is, I mean, becoming a duke is huge. It makes you, you're the next level down from the king and his family. So, like, what is he going to do all his life?
Yeah, I think he gets a little, like, drunk with power, if you will.
I think he needs a reason for it. I mean, he's done what his mother wanted him to do and what he wanted to do. Let's be honest about that.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just Julianne Moore monetizing her children.
Although she definitely does that more than once.
Well, she does do that. But she has to, yeah. I mean, I felt that... you know, there had to be a change somewhere. One of the things I found slightly disappointing was that Mary was pretty much blindfolded, straight ahead. Let's get power. Let's mess people about. And that didn't really change. I mean, why not stop when he'd got the dukedom? But I don't think she could.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's a line she says several times. So this may not actually even be a spoiler. About something to the it's basically to the effect of men don't ever stop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So why should I?
Yeah.
Because they don't stop like acquiring things mm-hmm. or people yes. or positions or money or power. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of offended that she's supposed to because she's a woman. Mm-hmm. So I like that.
Yes, well, life is uncertain. I mean, you could die of a paper cut any time. And she says this, you know, that she has to think about the rest of the children in the family, even though she thinks they're pretty useless.
I love that everyone hates her children.
Okay, so
literally everyone hates her kids.
Do you remember the wedding?
Okay, can I ask about her firstborn son? Because that's another one where I was like, do we know if him being a little soft in the head is true? Do we know anything about like her other kids? Do we know if any of that is real or is that all fictionalized?
I think it was recognized that there was something wrong with her eldest son. Okay. And she mentions syphilis in the first 5 minutes. There you go. This is a taste of things to come. And he's just rather a sad sack, really, except, mm-hmm. you know, he has accidents while playing with dogs. And
yeah, and we all know if you listen to true crime, what people who torture animals grow up to be.
Yeah.
Well, he said it was an accident.
Mm-hmm. Accident.
I to answer your question, I don't know. Yeah. Okay. I do know that I'm pretty sure like that marriage actually happened.
Mm-hmm. The marriage with
what's her face? Not the one that marries George, the one that marries the elder one.
Oh, the one who gets kidnapped.
But I mean, essentially,
yes right.
That happened. But yeah. I don't know anything. Obviously, history tends to remember the people that become the consorts of the King of England mm-hmm. and not their weird relatives.
Yeah.
I also had questions about, like, honestly, the opening scene in episode one where they show George's birth and they show her dropping George. I actually thought that he was going to be somehow deformed by her dropping him. Like, I was waiting for something to come out of that. And I was really startled that it was just kind of like it was supposed to be like a metaphor for him having to claw his way up or something instead of
it. I thought it was just meant to be like, here's where her sort of obsession with him started.
Okay, maybe
that's how I read it.
Was there not also a reference to the eldest son having the umbilical cord round his neck at birth, which probably would have caused brain damage, except it does seem to sort of pushed him to the psychopathic side of it.
Maybe, I don't know. I found it a little weird was the thing. And I was trying to figure out like what it was supposed to mean. And mm-hmm. like, I don't think
it's supposed to mean anything. I think that whole birth is supposed to be symbolic of like,
she's never going to cut the umbilical cord. In other
yeah,
words.
Cut, yes, yeah. pretty yeah. much. Like yeah. that she is, that George is hers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
Versus his father's.
Yeah. And I was expecting it to actually be something, not just a metaphor, is I guess what I mean. Mm-hmm. I just have to say that I love the cast of this. That's the other thing.
Yes.
I really like, before we go off on anything else, I just really, really, like, I started to talk about Julianne Moore, but I also, like, I'm not sure I'd ever seen Nicholas Galzenheim? How do you pronounce
it? He's the other hot one in Red, White, and Royal Blue.
One of the yes. hot ones.
Yes, and I had never actually seen Red, White, and Royal Blue, so that's why I didn't recognize him. But I thought he was great in this, and it yes. actually made me want to watch Red, White, and Royal yeah. Blue. And of course,
I thought he was fine. I unfortunately don't think the show actually asked him to do that much other than be like preternaturally attractive,
mm-hmm. yes.
which he does. He's great at.
Yeah. Yes.
So, thumbs up.
I was knocked out by Tony Curran. I thought he was amazing.
Same. He's actually my favorite part of yes. the whole show. I think he's wonderful.
Do you remember the mask scene?
He was Vincent Van Gogh in Doctor Who, and
yes.
he always will be to me.
Yes,
and he's so great in that role. And
if you like him, you should watch this little 2-episode show called Mayflies, which is
right.
so good.
Mm-hmm.
It's really sad. Yes. So like tissues. Mm-hmm. It's about like assisted death, but he's wonderful.
I thought the really impressive thing about Tony Curran's performance was that you could see him. I mean, it wasn't just lust. He was falling in love with this newcomer to the court. Well, partly because he was a newcomer too. I mean, the scene with the mask and the dancing, and he was just gazing at Galitzine. And I mean, it's intensely romantic. It wasn't all intensely romantic, but there were deep feelings involved there, and it was a real relationship. And although they were really pretty horrible to each other quite frequently, but that was the nature of being the king's favourite, that you could not guarantee how long you were going to be in favour. And Somerset, I believe, came to a sticky end. That was the one that that George supplanted.
Replaced.
That's the one that kept trying to kill Pete. That's the one that kept trying to kill George in the first couple of episodes.
He was very good looking too, but he was really an idiot, because everything he did to try and discredit George actually made the king pay more attention to him. You know, he falls over. He falls off his horse.
I actually really love, while we're on the subject of Tony Curran, I actually mm-hmm. really love so much about this performance, mm-hmm. but where for you, like, the romance of it spoke to you, I really loved how sort of quietly melancholic his performance is all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't do a lot of period dramas about James I, but his life was not, you know, a super easy one. His childhood, he was basically, like, taken from his mother and fought over by warring factions for most of his adult life. His mom got beheaded by his cousin. And, you know, he's spent his whole life trying to kind of balance these competing factions around him and hold on to power in a country that half of it doesn't want him there. And yes. I feel like he's constantly just trailing this kind of unspoken sadness around behind him. Like, you can see it comes up a little bit more later in the show, mm-hmm. but you can see just a lot of him still dealing with that, like, mm-hmm. underneath all the other stuff that's going on. Like, he doesn't want to go back to Scotland. He doesn't. Yeah, it's really sad.
Yes, he was terrified of assassination and of revolt
and witches.
Yeah, and witches.
They didn't put this in the show for some reason, but he was genuinely terrified of witches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really find it hard to sympathize with him over the witches, because almost certainly those women were innocent. And he was just being madly superstitious and killing them. And it was a horrible, horrible time in history.
If you want more on this, there is a Doctor Who episode called The Witchfinders that deals with King James I's witch hunts.
There is also a new biography of James I coming out this summer. And I can't remember, of course, who it's by. But he is giving a lecture which you can attend online in London this weekend. I think the British Museum has... I think it's British Museum who sponsors History Fest, and they have all sorts of different historians on, but I just happened to notice this one that popped up, and I thought, oh, wow, perhaps this is the age of, you know, new James I scholarship. And apparently, I mean, he really wasn't, he was both as bad as people said he was, and he also wasn't as bad as people said he was. And I think, you know, he was stuck in the court, he had his heirs, nobody had plotted against him seriously for some time. And I think he just wanted to enjoy himself. He uses the term peace and play, which I think is absolutely significant, because, I mean, he was incredibly paranoid about things, I think, having been brought up in this very entitled atmosphere and also being under threat as well. And that's why he fell out with Walter Raleigh. Apparently Walter Raleigh was... accused unjustly of being involved in a plot that he probably never even heard of. And then he was betrayed by his friends. And he was also a representative of the old regime as well. I think that was another thing too, that some of the characters who've been around for a while, like, let's see.
Who's the guy who hangs out with Raleigh all the time? Yeah. It's that guy.
Raleigh was really distracting to me because that's Benjen Stark from Game of Thrones.
Yes.
And I couldn't get past the fact that it was Benjen Stark from Game of Thrones, because he was going to die, and he was Benjen Stark. That was clearly going to die. Like, you know, like a way to channel that, like, Walter Raleigh is going to die in this show to me. Mm-hmm. And like,
well, I mean, it's history.
Yeah.
It's history.
I
mean,
I just, like, it's not spoilers, guys. It's history.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No,
Look
I have
it
to
up.
Agree
Wikipedia
with that.
is free.
The fact that also, like, and this is because I've only watched the first two episodes, I don't actually know, like, how the show will handle this or if the show even bothers to handle this. You know, the fact that James isn't just James the First, he's James the First and he's James the Sixth. Because he's kind of uniting Scotland and England. And this is
kind of. He is uniting Scotland and England. He's the first king of a united England and Scotland.
Yes. And this is where we start to get the UK basically forming via the monarchy. And so I feel very much that, like, there's a strand of story there that I don't know if and I'm curious, Lacey, since you've seen all the episodes, if the show actually deals with that at all, or if that's sort of just something that it doesn't really want to deal with.
I mean, it's sort of always there in the background a little bit because he does not trust a lot of his sort of English courtiers.
And with good reason.
Yes. And he doesn't like to go back to Scotland, although I think that's probably more of the fact that he was, like, kept a literal prisoner there for most of his childhood. But, you know, I think he has a lot of complicated feelings about it as a character. And I think that that is something that runs underneath a lot of the tensions in his court.
Okay.
It's not something that I would say they, like, have an episode or anything on, but it is, like, there's a lot of factions at work and a lot of people who have different goals and things they want from him. And that is part of it. But I wouldn't say that it's a major plot point.
Okay. The other thing I was very curious about, and again, this is as Janet noted, this is why that we don't usually, this is why we sort of usually stop at the end of Elizabeth the First and say, "And Shakespeare curtain," is because what follows James the First is Charles the First, and what follows Charles the First is Charles the First's head coming off and rolling away.
young Charles is in later episodes.
Okay. Is there any foreshadowing of the whole revolution that's going to come where the British monarchy does fall? And then we realize that we liked the monarchy, so we're going to put Charles II back.
Yeah, but I think it's hinted at, because certainly James gets into trouble because he runs out of money. He gets heavily into debt and he won't call Parliament. He has to have his arm twisted to call Parliament so he can go and make nice and get some more money. Because, of course, what is going to happen if he doesn't get money from his own country? He may well get it from elsewhere, which is what Charles II did. And so Charles II was being paid off by the French. And also, Britain had been so depleted with wars with Spain that I don't think Spain or James I by this time are really interested in going to war together, which is why you get this make nice treaty trying to marry his son Charles, the future Charles I, to a Spanish princess, because they were just tired of spending all their resources, both countries.
The other thing, and this is probably my last question that kind of, like, hit me while I was watching the first two episodes. You know, one of the things that Starz did here, or that Starz has been doing for a while now, is it's been doing all the Philippa Gregory books of, you know, the War of the Roses, followed by the Spanish princess, followed by becoming Elizabeth. Now, I know, and
Becoming Elizabeth is not based on a Philippa Gregory novel, she said, having read all of them.
Sorry. But in a way, we have been doing English history in relative order here. Of covering, starting, you know, back with the War of the Roses through Henry VIII and up to Elizabeth. And I know that Mary and George was not originally a Starz production, that this was originally a co-production between Sky Atlantic over in the UK and AMC Networks, and that this was originally planned as an AMC Plus / Acorn / BBC America show that would have run on one or three or maybe Sundance Now or whatever, like, it within those niche, and that basically the slow collapse of AMC Networks is partly why this went up on the block and Starz basically snatched it up, because honestly it fits it was perfect, it went next, right? Because that's where they were in the chronology. I don't know if they're planning on doing a Charles next, but do we think they should? B, no. Do we like the idea of them continuing this chronology?
I don't think they're doing this chronology on purpose.
No. Yes. I don't think they are either. But do we like the fact that they have sort of accidentally done this? Do we want to see this accident continue? And do we think that they should deliberately find themselves a Charles show? Would we like to see that?
I would love to see a smart and sexy and intelligent retelling of the Civil War with the roundheads and all the wackos like the diggers or the levelers or whatever they were getting their due in history. Because there was a lot of very radical stuff going on and you don't really hear about it. Where there were communities where women got equality with men, for instance. And that's just something that's overlooked. It's like, oh, well, this was like a flash in the pan and then it went away. But I don't think it ever really did. I think it certainly had a bearing on the trade union movement, you know, 200 years later. So I really would like to see that. And I don't know about Charles I. I mean, it's tricky. He pretty much became a saint. I mean, was he a genuine saint, Lacey? He may have been.
That's a great question.
Because he was Catholic, secretly Catholic, wasn't he?
And one to which I do not immediately know the answer. I will Google while you talk.
Oh, excuse us.
I'll answer your question and then I'll Google and come back.
Oh, okay.
Because I think you're looking at this in kind of the wrong way. Mm-hmm. Because I don't, they're not purposefully doing a
no,
story.
No. I'm aware that they're not purposefully doing this, but I couldn't help but. Okay, anyway. Yes. Go.
I'm not done yet.
Okay.
They're not doing that. What they are purposefully doing, I think, and the reason why they acquired the show and why it fits so well with all the other shows they've done is they are finding stories of women in history who are not normally like the focal point of things. Yes, they did two shows about the War of the Roses, but they were really shows about Elizabeth Woodville and Elizabeth of York.
True.
Yes, they did a story about Henry VIII, but it was the story of Catherine of Aragon.
True. Like, yes, it was the Spanish princess.
Find me the women in these places and then let's do it. I know Starz is working on a show about Eleanor of Aquitaine, which I'm really excited about.
Which we haven't heard a lot of movement on, unfortunately, and I would really love to know more about.
You know, find me more of these pockets of women we don't talk about and fit it in that way,
as
opposed to like we have to follow this order of, you know, kings or historical periods or whatever. Like there are. What is the name of like you could make a whole nother. Is it that's coming up that has Anna Skew in it? Anyway, there's if you want to stay in this period, there are plenty of stories of women like Anna Skew, who is going to appear in a show that I can't remember the name of, possibly the Serpent Queen.
Maybe
I don't know.
It might be the Serpent Queen. That sounds about right.
Who was a female preacher who was burned as a witch? Like, find more of these stories about the stories we don't tell about the women of history. That's what this whole like run of shows has been so great and so deliberate about doing. And that's what I think they should do next. I don't really care where that happens. Like, do Queen Anne, do Queen Mary, like, find it that way.
Mm. So maybe like maybe do Anne of Denmark, who was Charles I's mother, or Henrietta Maria of France, who was Charles I's wife. Mm-hmm. Like those are the kinds of things that you're looking for. Like that would make sense to me. Like I could see that. I could also see like trying to hit, you know, I mean, I can understand maybe trying to hit the roundheads through a female perspective. I mean, that would definitely be a very different kind of show on the revolution. I mean, I have to agree with Janet that there has never really been a good show on the English Revolution. Period. Mm-hmm. Like there just isn't. And I feel like there should be. Like, but also, as you say, there are things about the revolution that never have been dug into, that perspectives that would be fascinating to find. And I think female perspectives would be an absolutely great way to dig into that. You know, even if there's no other even if there is literally no other way to talk about it, you know, there's just, you know, and there are, you know, in the same way that, like, the Philippa Gregory ones, you know, they went for Catherine of Aragon, you know, they went for Elizabeth Woodville, they went for Elizabeth of York. There are women throughout all of these courts that they could easily focus on, you know, mm-hmm. like we have, like, you know, we have, like, I don't even remember who Charles II married, and I probably should, but I don't.
Catherine of Braganza, which was a very bizarre match.
You actually remember. Okay, cool. Yeah, like that's the kind of thing. Like, again, yeah. like these are stories that like stars could mm-hmm. absolutely smash into. Mm-hmm. Or that like Sky Atlantic could smash into and stars could grab onto. You know, I was making fun of AMC Networks earlier because I've been very mean about those who are losing the streaming wars, and I really shouldn't be. I should be much nicer, because it's hard when this kind of thing happens, you know.
Mm-hmm. One thing I did want to say is this production mm-hmm. is absolutely beautiful visually. Mm-hmm. They did not use a single green screen in this. You know,
really, I didn't know that.
Yeah, the green screens that drive me crazy are the ones where you have like a shot of the Houses of Parliament with birds flying around it. It's like, we have to put birds in this, otherwise people won't believe it. But it was filmed in a lot of historic locations that had not been used for filming before. And Tony Curran said something weird about one time. There was an orgy scene and it was being filmed inside an old house. And the owners of the house or the National Trust or whoever said... you can't let anything get wet in here.
Oh, anyway.
And apparently well, they managed it.
Well, I'm sure there were lots of rubber sheets.
Yes.
And that is about as risque as I think this podcast is going to get.
That is our show. Janet, tell people where they can find you on the internet.
Oh, good Lord. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter under Janet_Mullaney. I'm on Blue Sky, but I actually haven't done anything other than sitting around on it. So I'm not really into social media a whole lot. Well, it's been such a pleasure.
Annie, your turn.
I am Annie Bundle, and I am Annie Bundle everywhere on the internet because I'm the only one. I'm the associate editor here at Televisions, and I also freelance for the web. Just Google me and find my bylines because I love writing, and I write way too much.
Huzzah! I am Lacey MB on all of the platforms that let you pick a username. If you have thoughts, questions, we would love to hear that from you. You can send those things to me at any of those platforms or email us at televisions@weta.org. If you just want the site and the pod, we are at televisions.org, where you can find news, recaps, listicles, reviews, interviews with a variety of people, all kinds of things. And if you are so inclined while you're there, you can click on that donate button up top to help us keep making all of this content that comes your way every day. That rhymed and I didn't mean it to. I'm sorry. That is our show. I don't know. My back is killing me because I'm sitting on the floor again and I forgot how much I hated this. But take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Thanks for listening and we'll see you next week.